hand it off to Tanya Howell from EPA Region 7. Again, she's a Superfund redevelopment coordinator there, to begin today's presentation. So, Tanya, I'll be calling up your materials, and I'll turn it over to you to get started.
Thanks, Jean, and welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining us for this EPA Superfund redevelopment webinar. My name is Tanya Howe, and I am the EPA Region 7 Superfund Redevelopment Coordinator. I've been a remedial project manager in the Superfund program for over 20 years, and I firmly believe that Superfund's end goal is to not only ensure sites are cleaned up so that they are protective of human health and the environment, but that these sites can be put back into productive reuse. EPA Superfund Redevelopment webinars share valuable site reuse information, success stories, as well as challenges, with the hope that these stories will inspire you to consider reuse on other blighted properties. Each webinar provides guidance, tools, and lessons learned to support the appropriate reuse of Superfund sites. I am so glad you have joined us for today's webinar, so let's get started. Next slide. During today's webinar, we will focus on EPA's involvement at removal action sites and how these cleanup actions have led to the successful redevelopment of properties in the Kansas City metropolitan area. Next slide. Here is a preview of what we will be covering today. I will start with a brief background on Superfund redevelopment and the benefits of redeveloping contaminated properties. Andrew Gisake, an EPA on-scene coordinator in Region 7, will then present information on the successful reuse and redevelopment of some removal action sites focusing on the Kansas City metropolitan area. Andrew will share lessons learned and information for those interested in Superfund site reuse, including commercial, residential, agricultural, and industrial redevelopment. I will then conclude the webinar with a list of resources and the question and answer session. Next slide. Superfund redevelopment works with communities and other partners in considering future use opportunities and integrating appropriate reuse options into the selected remedy. It is important to note that reuse considerations can and should be explored at any point during the Superfund cleanup process. There are many different ways to reuse Superfund sites, and there is no one-size-fits-all solution to determining which reuse type will be most appropriate. Contaminated sites pose unique challenges in terms of both cleanup and reuse. However, they can also allow for a broad spectrum of safe and productive reuse possibilities. Returning contaminated properties to productive use is an important part of EPA's mission. The Superfund Task Force has developed recommendations for action and is diligently working to see these goals realized. If you're interested in finding out more about the task force, feel free to check out the link in the resources pod on the right of your screen. For more information about EPA Superfund redevelopment reuse efforts, I would encourage you to visit the Superfund redevelopment website. The link to the website is here on the slide and also listed in your resources pod on the right side of your screen. The pictures on this slide are of recent events where EPA recognized the successful redevelopment of Superfund sites. On the left side of the slide, you will see a picture from September 16, 2019, when EPA Region 10 presented its Howard Orlean Excellence in Site Reuse Award to a variety of stakeholders for their work to reuse the North Ridge Estate Superfund site located in Klamath Falls, Oregon. The cleanup has returned the site to productive use as a residential neighborhood. Over half of the homes have already been sold and reoccupied. On the right side of the slide, you will see a picture from July 31, 2019, when EPA Region 9 presented the Excellence in Site Reuse Award to Operating Industries, Inc. Site Custodial Trust, the City of Monterey Park, and M&M Realty Partners for their efforts to redevelop the Operating Industries Industrial, Inc. Superfund site in Monterey Park, California. A retail center constructed on site hosts a variety of stores, restaurants, and parking. Next slide. I encourage you to visit the Redevelopment Partnerships page of the Superfund Redevelopment website to learn more about the specific organizations that have partnered with Superfund Redevelopment to assist in Superfund site reuse. Collaborating with these organizations helps Superfund Redevelopment provide appropriate tools and resources to turn reuse visions and plans into reality. Superfund Redevelopment currently has partnerships with the Academy of Model Aeronautics, the U.S. Soccer Foundation, the Rails to Trails Conservancy, the Trust for Public Land, and the Pollinator Partnership. These organizations are familiar with Superfund and are willing to work with communities, municipalities, or other stakeholders to explore reuse opportunities and resources for their local Superfund sites. Before I turn the presentation over to Andrew, I have one final note. Please feel free to submit questions throughout the webinar, And as Jean said, we will have time at the end of the presentation to address some of these questions. Now Andrew will take us through an overview of removal sites and reuse in the Kansas City metropolitan area. Go ahead, Andrew.
Hello, everyone, and thanks for joining us. My name is Andrew Giesecke. I'm on-scene coordinator with EPA Region 7. I have been with the agency since 2014. A little background about myself. My master's degree is in environmental assessment, so a lot of that played into reuse at Superfund sites. And I still use that today with this group. During today's presentation, I'll be discussing about removal reuse in the Kansas City metropolitan area, where these removal actions have tackled a lot of environmental hazards and they protect human health. The successful reuse of these sites shows how removal action sites can continue to be important assets in the community across the country. And that consideration of reuse and continued use is an important part of the cleanup planning and implementation. I'll provide information and lessons learned for parties interested in Superfund sites, reuse, commercial, reuse and commercial, residential, agricultural, and industrial redevelopment. Each year, thousands of emergencies involving oil spills or the release or threatened release of hazardous substances are reported in the United States. These emergencies range from small-scale spills to large incidents requiring prompt action and even evacuation of nearby populations. EPA's emergency response program responds to these oil spills, chemical, biological, radiological, and even nuclear incidents and large-scale national emergencies, including homeland security incidents. The EPA provides support when requested or when state and local first responder capabilities have been exceeded. Through coordinating and implementing a wide range of activities, the EPA conducts short-term cleanups, and these are called removal actions. To protect human health and the environment, OSCs do these removal actions. This is done by funding response actions directly or overseeing and enforcing actions led by the potentially responsible parties. Incidents involving the release or threatened release of hazardous substance that endanger human health or the environment may occur anywhere at any time. And under Superfund, EPA may respond to these releases or threats of releases of hazardous substances by starting a removal action. Although there are some exceptions, removal actions generally last no longer than 12 months and they cost no more than $2 million. The long-term corrective actions are referred to the EPA's remedial response program, the other side of Superfund, for further investigation and assessment. Generally, when we finish these short-term removal actions, if there's continued waste on site, we'll go and do a scoring to see if they can score high enough for the national priority list. The EPA Region 7 has divisions with specific responsibilities, and the Superfund and Emergency Management Division is responsible for cleaning up and restoring the contaminated lands and natural resources to safeguard and revitalize communities. This is accomplished by managing and implementing a broad spectrum of emergency responses, cleanups, and land revitalization programs. And the photo seen here on the right was actually one of the first sites that I assisted with when I became an OSC. It was a PCB polychlorinated biphenyls contaminated site right outside the Kansas City area. And this site is actually being reused now for recycling and storage of recycling containers. On the left is a sawmill, an old sawmill that I cleaned up this past year, actually, that was contaminated with dioxins. And through cleaning it up, it's going back into reuse through personal usage and storage. In the Kansas City area, which includes Kansas City, Missouri, and Kansas City, Kansas, it's played a pretty important role in American history as a vibrant and cultural and economic hub and a gateway to the West. As with many cities in the United States, industrialization brought environmental challenges as well as economic and community benefits. The Kansas City metropolitan area is representative of many industrial areas across the United States where contamination of buildings, soil, or groundwater has occurred from manufacturing operations, improper disposal of contaminants, or other spills and explosions. Removal action activities at the 24 sites in the Kansas City metropolitan area are included. Cleaning the interior buildings, decontamination, demolition, and removal of buildings, drum and container removal, evacuation and disposal of contaminated soil, excavation and disposal of contaminated soils, groundwater testing, removal and recycling of an underground storage tank, removal of blast fire extinguishers, removal of radiological materials, and the removal of waste and other hazardous substances. Of the 24 sites that we have, 24 sites in the Kansas City metropolitan area were looked at by our redevelopment navigation team, which I'll explain later on in my presentation here that we developed. And out of those 24, I'll be talking about four of these sites today. The first one is Osage Metals Company site, and then Kansas City Structural Steel site, PCB Incorporated on Missouri, and a St. Drum site. The photograph shown here is just of the Kansas City skyline on the left and the Missouri River in northern Kansas City, Missouri on the right. The Osage Metal Company site is in the Armourdale neighborhood in Kansas City, Kansas. It was a metals salvage and reclamation facility located on the site there. Transformers and batteries were emptied onto the ground, and this resulted in a lot of PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls, being released, along with lead contamination in the soil. The removal action dug up almost 12,000 tons of contaminated soil and then treated them and then disposed of them off-site. Once the removal was completed, in 1999, the property was sold off to Knit-Rite Incorporated. The company is a designer, marketer, and manufacturer of textiles for medical and consumer markets. This business now employs 170 people and generates $20 million in annual sales revenue. This site, along with the next site, oddly enough, are only about 2 or 3 miles away from my home, so they kind of have a special place in my heart. The Kansas City Structural Steel site is in the Argentine neighborhood in Kansas City, Kansas. In the early 1900s, the site was the largest silver and lead smelter in the world. It closed in the 1980s, and in 1993, the potentially responsible party decontaminated, demolished, and removed the site buildings contaminated with heavy metals. Drums and contaminated soils were also removed and backfilled with clean soil. The site's location near a transportation infrastructure, including a railroad and highway access, as well as commercial, industrial, and residential properties, made it a good candidate for redevelopment. The cleanup included demolition of vacant structures and the consolidation of contamination under a soil cap. And a local nonprofit worked with EPA to acquire the property and seek out reuse opportunities. Obstacles addressed during the redevelopment included site development restrictions. Extensive outreach helped build the community support for the project. Both the Osage Metal site and the Kansas City Structural Steel site have environmental justice neighborhoods located very near to them. There's a lot of industrial area around these homes, and this location where Kansas City Structural Steel was or is, was also a food desert, is what we call it. And in 2014, part of the site was redeveloped as a Walmart neighborhood market, or their grocery store chain. And then in 2014, EPA Region 7 presented a Leading Environmentalism and Forwarding Sustainability, or LEAFS, award to Walmart and the Argentine neighborhood for the Development Association for the reuse efforts. The other part of the site in 2017, the Kansas City South Patrol Police Substation was built. Today, the area includes La Plaza, Argentine, a shopping center, and other property ready for redevelopment. The Walmart business employs 65 people and provides nearly $1.5 million in estimated annual employment income. The Kansas City South Patrol Police Station employs 50 people. Our third site is PCB Inc., Missouri. PCB Inc., Missouri site is in the Crossroads Art District of Kansas City, Missouri. This area has had a lot of redevelopment in the past decade. A lot of cultural arts things go on here. We have a First Fridays program where art galleries are open and the streets see crowds of people First Friday of every month during the warm parts of the year. In 1982 and to 1987, PCB Treatment Incorporated, or PTI, managed and processed electrical equipment on the property. In total, over 25 million pounds of PCB contaminated materials were sent to PTI for treatment and disposal. The process contaminated the building's floors and walls with PCBs. Cleanup took place in 2004 and 2005. The seven-story building was dismantled floor by floor. More than 19,000 tons of debris and soil were removed. And in its place, developers quickly noticed that the site's property potential. And the real estate development company, Cope & Brooks, acquired the property in 2007. Initial plans for a condominium project did not move forward because of the economic downturn in 2008. Following development of an updated plan and improved economic conditions, work began on a new residential development in 2017. In 2019, the Artera, a 12-story luxury residential building, the first high-rise apartment project built in the Crossroads Art District area of downtown Kansas City, opened on site. Artera offers 126 state-of-the-art residential units, first floor retail, an integrated parking garage, and an infinity pool overlooking the Liberty Memorial, the World War I monument here in Kansas City, and the Crossroads Art District. Cope & Brooks and Atlas Properties jointly developed the project. The Artera residential tower serves as a visual beacon the development and growth in the area. Our fourth site, St. John Drum. In 2006, the Northeast Arts Kansas City nonprofit created the St. John Community Garden. This transformed a vacant lot into a neighborhood amenity. The St. John Drum site here in Kansas City, in 2001, EPA removed non-hazardous and hazardous waste-filled drums from a building scheduled for demolition by the city. The community garden includes more than two dozen raised beds and several fruit trees. There's a number of removal sites and remedial sites in the Kansas City area that have done such a thing here as a community garden. One other notable site is called CCI in Olathe in the southern part of Kansas City, a suburb of Kansas City, where a lot of contamination was removed over time through the remedial program and removal actions, and is also a community garden and butterfly garden. Some lessons learned. Based upon a review of the removal action sites featured, some factors stand out as having contributed to the cleanup and successful redevelopment or continued use in the Kansas City metro area. Cooperation and coordination across multiple parties is often crucial. Involving local governments, community members, and developers at the very beginning of a removal action improves the chances the site will be reused in a productive way and will become an asset to the surrounding community. Non-public service uses, e.g. commercial, retail, or residential, are often dependent upon market conditions. Even after removal sites are cleaned up, market conditions may delay these types of redevelopment projects. Public services uses may be accommodated more readily than non-public services, public service uses following cleanup. Sites with public service uses may be less dependent upon market conditions and may be implemented sooner than market-oriented redevelopment projects, especially when market conditions are volatile. Nonprofit organizations can be a catalyst in spurring redevelopment. Nonprofit organizations help energize redevelopment plans in both Kansas City Structural Steel and the St. John Drum site, tongue twister there, that accommodated local community interests. To aid Region 7's redevelopment goals and in response to the lessons learned, EPA Region 7 brought together a redevelopment navigation team to put together a reuse navigation guide as a tool for OSCs to integrate reuse into our removals. The redevelopment navigation team is composed of people from all sorts of divisions throughout EPA Region 7. We have people from Council, RCRA, and the water program, and it's a lot of minds that come together that can help assist OSCs and remedial project managers with guiding them through reuse at their sites. We found this to be a useful tool to remind those OSCs of the reuse assets we have, to remind them of the places in the process of the removal process where reuse can be considered, and how to provide a few examples, and we provided a few examples of what kinds of sites could be considered for reuse. If you'd like a copy of this, please send me an email and I'll pass one along to you. In conclusion, the cleanup and redevelopment of removal action Superfund sites in Kansas City area illustrates how local leadership, collaboration with EPA and state and community partners, and flexible planning can result in several major outcomes: the protection of human health and the environment, productive redevelopment or continued business operations, and new community assets. The culture of the OSC at EPA in the past has been to go in and do these removal actions and then step away from them and go on to the next one. So with this redevelopment navigation guide and an emphasis on reuse through SCEO, we can make this a bigger part of our process where we can look at the removal process and start working our way to a remediation of the site that will help assist with redevelopment. Several cleaned up but unused sites represent opportunities to support efforts underway locally to improve the quality of life, transportation infrastructure, and employment opportunities in the Kansas City area. EPA remains committed to supporting the safe use of removal sites. In coordination with state and local partners, both in Kansas City, in the Kansas City area, and across the United States. If you have any questions regarding removal process and how reuse can be used in the removal process, feel free to contact me at any time. And again, if you'd like to see the navigation guide, feel free to contact me and I'll forward you a copy. Now Tanya will conclude today's presentation with resource and questions and answer. Thank you.
Thanks, Andrew, for that presentation. It was interesting to hear about the different ways removal action sites in Region 7 have been reused. Showcasing successful case studies is a very important part of the Superfund redevelopment mission. Along with providing examples, we have found that sharing guidance, tools, lessons learned, and resources is an impactful way to promote safe and beneficial reuse. Another big thank you to Andrew for his participation in today's webinar. I would like to wrap up our time today by providing you with some resources, and then we will address questions that have been submitted. Next slide. This slide lists some of the tools available for encouraging redevelopment at Superfund sites. I'm not going to read through this list of resources now, but you can find links to all these resources in the resources panel. If you need more information than is provided in these resources, or if you would like to find out which resources would best suit your interest, you can always contact the Regional Superfund Redevelopment Coordinator, and they can assist you in navigating the most applicable resources for your needs and answer any questions you may have. Next slide. Provided on this slide and also available in the resources panel is the link to the Superfund Task Force final report. This report outlines the accomplishments of the Superfund Task Force. Next slide. Here's a list of my fellow Superfund redevelopment coordinators by region. As I mentioned earlier, if you have any region-specific or site-specific questions, these are the folks you should reach out to as needed. They can either answer your questions regarding the reuse of Superfund sites, or they can put you in contact with team members that can respond to site-specific inquiries. Again, I'm not going to read off these names at this point in time, but they are included here in these slides, which are available to you. Next slide. If you have any general questions or would like more information about Superfund redevelopment, please don't hesitate to contact the project manager for EPA Superfund redevelopment, Frank Avisato. His contact information is provided on the slide. And at this point, I would like to take some time to answer a few questions that have been submitted during our webinar today. While we're going over the questions, we're going to switch the screen view to the survey screen. Please take a minute to respond to the survey while we answer some participant questions. And also, want to mention we have Phil Page from the Office of Site Remediation Enforcement joining us to answer any questions you may have about liability. So thanks, Phil, for joining us as well. So the first question I have is, at what phase of the Superfund process should the site team begin discussions regarding reuse? Well, whether it's a removal or a remedial site, the site team should begin discussion of site reuse as soon as possible within the Superfund process. And that's because understanding the potential future use of the property will help determine the appropriate cleanup goals and what you're trying to achieve at that site. However, having said that, discussions regarding potential site reuse can occur at any time during the Superfund process. Another question is, how do I engage with one of the Superfund redevelopment partnerships you discussed earlier, and what types of support do they provide? So the SRI partners can provide a variety of support for Superfund redevelopment, from site design and planning assistance to research and spatial analysis using GIS. Contact information for these partners is listed on the Superfund redevelopment partnership website, which is linked in the related URLs pod. You can also contact Frank Avisato with headquarters or the Superfund redevelopment coordinators in your region if you're interested in engaging with one of these Superfund redevelopment partners, they can help put you in contact with the right person to answer any questions you may have. And again, those partners are the Rails to Trails Conservancy, Pollinator Partnership, U.S. Soccer Foundation, and the Academy of Model Aeronautics. And they're used to working with us on Superfund sites and are usually eager to help communities figure out if it's an appropriate reuse or something they can assist with on a Superfund site. Another question is, how does a detailed site plan help facilitate removal action site reuse? Andrew, would you like to take this since it's regarding removal sites?
Sure. You know, detailed site reuse plans save a lot of time and reduce the cost of redevelopment. Detailed reuse considerations can inform the future location of groundwater monitoring wells and other operations and maintenance equipment that might inadvertently hinder redevelopment efforts. It's a good thing to go in when you're going in and doing a removal action, say the dig and haul, if you can put back dirt in a manner that would help facilitate any sort of redevelopment.
Thanks, Andrew. So the next question I have is, how do I find information on a site's cleanup status, any property restrictions, and if it is safe for reuse? So most sites are safe for some type of reuse. It just depends on the proposed reuse and the site status. You can start by researching sites on EPA's online Superfund Enterprise Management System, which you can Google for. And you can read about the site cleanup status and any current site restrictions. On these sites, you'll also find contact information for the EPA remedial project manager and or the on-scene coordinator. So you can reach out to them directly, or you can always, again, just contact the Superfund redevelopment coordinator for each region and find out who the appropriate people are. They can connect you with the right people within the team for certain sites and get you started moving along with whether or not the proposed reuse is compatible with the remedy and can even assist you with available liability protections. Next question I have is, what are the advantages to buying a property within a Superfund site? Well, Superfund sites are often located in a very strategic areas that are close to various types of infrastructure, whether it's railroads or highways or just having ground electricity, water, stuff that runs to them. So Superfund sites are also some of the most environmentally characterized sites out there. So there'll be fewer surprises, and you should be able to better manage any risk so you know what you're getting up front. There are also great federal liability protections as well as available redevelopment tools to ensure the proposed reuse is compatible with the remedy while still remaining protective. Next question I have is, what constraints are there for developing removal action sites? Andrew, again, since this is dealing with removal sites, do you want to take that one?
Yeah, unless removal action site cleanup has a very limited scope, there may be constraints posed by the cleanup that affects the redevelopment options, such as to what level do we clean up any contamination at a site? It's important to factor in and consider when evaluating these removal actions on the redevelopment projects that may happen at the site. This can affect the cleanup that's conducted, the extent of the cleanup, whether there will be restrictions such as the environmental covenants put in place on the site when it's completed. It's important to be talking to the property owners and the cities to see what, well, and the, more importantly, the communities that are impacted by these sites, and get out there and get a feel for what could potentially be going in there. I'm getting ready to work on a site in Bettendorf, Iowa here that there's a lot of residential development going on in the area where there's old dumping and oil dumped onto the site. And so it's really important for me to get in touch with the city administrator, local government, and then local business owners around the area, along with the community members, the residences that live around there, and talk to them about what I'll be doing. And when I get out there and do that to explain what the EPA will be doing at the site, I can then, through my conversations, get a feel for what they might like to see for reuse action at the site.
Thanks, Andrew. Next question I have is, how can a developer best mitigate environmental risk when developing a contaminated site? Bill, would you like to take this one?
Yes. So we offer a variety of liability protection tools for developers at these contaminated sites. The very first tool that we offer is a comfort letter. The comfort letter basically says, this is what we know about the site, this is what you probably can do on the site, and as long as you follow these reasonable steps, you're okay. The next series of tools are either prospective purchaser agreements or BIF, bona fide prospective purchaser agreements. Those are tools that provide liability relief, and they are drafted in conjunction with the Department of Justice, whichever region you're in, and they are reviewed by headquarters personnel. And in fact, in the Kansas City structural steel that Andrew mentioned, there was a prospective purchaser agreement in the late 90s that allowed the purchaser to buy the property. He got the purchaser got liability protection, but then when Walmart came along in the mid-2000s, or 2014, I think, we had to update that prospective purchaser agreement and amend it to make it more to comply with the laws as they were then written and with some court cases and that sort of thing, and to provide the liability protection that was needed. So an enforcement tool in that instance was very critical to the ultimate development where the Walmart was located and the police station was located. So we are here to help you develop those tools. And when I say here, headquarters, but the regions will they have teams that will look at the site. If a tool is needed, they contact headquarters, and we work together to get the tool out there to provide the liability relief that is needed for these. Now, a bona fide prospective purchaser under the law does not necessarily need this tool, because if they follow the requirements found in CERCLA, CERCLA 10140, that's the section, then they have a defense that they can use to develop a site. But there are a lot of sites that the developers, that the remedy is fairly complicated, and they want to make sure that they are getting the liability protection, so they come in for a PPA, prospective purchaser agreement, or a BFPP, a bona fide prospective purchaser agreement. There's those two tools are very similar. There's some slight differences and some nuances that I don't need to go into here, but they are available for the redevelopment of contaminated sites. Thank you.
Thanks, Phil. So the next question I have is, what is the difference between Superfund remedial sites and removal action sites? Andrew, would you like to take that one?
Sure. So in the 80s, if you're unfamiliar with Superfund, Congress established the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liabilities Act, or CERCLA law. And it's informally called Superfund. This allows EPA to do cleanup of contaminated sites, and it forces parties that are responsible for the contamination to either perform the cleanup or reimburse the government for their EPA's lead cleanup work. When there's no responsible party that we can find associated with the site, then Superfund gives the EPA the funding and authority to conduct the cleanup of the contaminated sites. In the EPA's Emergency Response Program, which is a part of Superfund, we respond to the oil spills, chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear incidents, and large-scale emergencies. And we do the short-term cleanup, like I spoke about in my presentation, where it's under 12 months or $2 million generally. If it goes above that, then it needs congressional approval or headquarters approval to either get increased funding or time. And when we conduct or when we conclude a removal action in that short time, basically we're getting in there to get the threat, the immediate threat to human health and the environment. If there's waste remaining, then we'll score it. If it makes it onto the national priorities list, then it'll go onto the remedial side of Superfund for long-term remediation, such as putting in pump and treat systems, you know, taking care of groundwater contamination that unfortunately takes longer to do or requires a lot more funding than what the removal program has provided. The EPA provides support when we're requested by the state, and then we'll go in and take over from there looking for the potential responsible parties and or just going in and doing the cleanup.
Thanks, Andrew. And you've touched a little bit on this. What do you believe the challenges are for looking at reuse on removal sites versus on the remedial side? And I know you don't work on the remedial side, but removal seems to offer its own set of challenges for trying to consider reuse or looking at reuse as you move forward. And again, I know you touched on this some, but I just kind of wanted to draw a distinction between the remedial and the removal side of the house and the importance of reuse.
Well, I think the two biggest factors between the two are time and money. The remedial side has a lot more funding. They have the time to go in and assess a problem, really get to know the community and work with the community. They have the time to find partners for reuse, whereas with the removal action, OSCs, we need to be thinking about it at the very beginning when we're doing the site investigation or receiving this from the site assessment managers or from the state, and we're getting out and we're doing our first glance at a site. We have a very limited amount of time to include this into our removal action. Granted, a lot of our removal actions are just picking up a drum that's sitting out in an alley, or you know, they can be as complex as going and digging up a bunch of yards in the community that are contaminated with lead. Those kinds of actions, you know, don't lend themselves to reuse necessarily, whereas, you know, we're playing with the notion of the fact that we go and clean a yard up, it's technically going into reuse. I don't think we've really fleshed that one out yet as far as taking credit for it, but technically, the yard is getting reused again. But, you know, when you get these sites like the steel site in Kansas City or the PCB sites, those are the medium term. The, you know, they're going to be a year under $2 million. And you have just a limited amount of time to get in there, and you got to look at every part of the process for any sort of reuse potential.
Thanks, Andrew. And then, Phil, kind of along the same lines, a question for you. Is there any differences in the liability protections whether a site is addressed under a removal or addressed under a remedial, or is it pretty much the same tools and resources that are out there?
It's pretty much the same tools and resources that are out there. The bona fide prospective purchaser agreement, BFPPA, or the prospective purchaser agreement provide the liability relief that is needed for a lot of developers. If you're coming in as a BFPP, a bona fide prospective purchaser, you don't really need an agreement. Some developers prefer to have an agreement, but the liability relief in both of those documents, and those are the highest documents you need. Sometimes all you need is a comfort status letter, but going back to the agreements, the liability relief covers work on the site or on the property, and sometimes a developer will purchase a parcel of a Superfund site, whether it's a removal site or a remedial site, and that's the property. And so the protection goes to the existing contamination on that property, and that's a defined term within the agreement, the work to be done on that, and as well as in some cases there's monies that need to be paid or the developer agreed to pay for either past cost or future oversight costs. So that's what's encompassed in the liability protection. So if a developer comes in and goes beyond the work needed to be performed in some way, and each case is site specific, then that developer could possibly become liable for the entire site. So we work very closely with the regions, with DOJ, and with the developing party, the purchasing party, to make sure that they understand exactly what their requirements are, the limitations of the liability protection, so that there's no misunderstanding. And we've done literally hundreds of these over the course of the years from the mid-1990s to today. And we don't have any problems. I think we've had one or two times when we've had to maybe go after a purchaser. But it's very rare, these things take a while to draft, but that's because we want to make sure that everybody's on the same page and we understand what the requirements are of each party. So that's the long answer. The short answer is there's really not any difference between the liability protections that we provide for a removal site versus a remedial site. That's it. Thanks.
Thanks, Phil. So that's all the questions that I believe we can answer during the live webinar for today. And I just want to say that I was happy we were able to do this webinar because the remedial side of the house, when it comes to Superfund, seems to get a lot of attention when it comes to reuse. And we wanted to take a moment to recognize the success stories for those who work on the removal side of the Superfund program. They don't get highlighted as much as the other remedial side. So I appreciate the opportunity to let Andrew talk about some of the work that our removal program does. Like I said, Gina, I think we're out of questions that can be answered during the webinar, so I'm passing it back to you.
All right. Thank you so very much. I want to echo your thanks for everyone who was able to join us. We had over 100 people on live today, and I want to thank our presenters who helped share their expertise. I have just a few final reminders to share with the audience before we close things out today. First, I encourage you all to visit us at the Cleanup Information Network or CLUIN.org to look for additional resources on cleaning up hazardous waste sites. And you also might want to consider signing up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, which goes out on the first of each month, and it highlights free webinars like today's session. contact information for our presenters and organizers, along with copies of their presentation materials and a wide variety of related resources and websites have already been posted on that seminar homepage. I highlighted that at the start of today's session. It's the URL that would have been provided to you in your confirmation and webinar reminder emails. You'll find tabs on that page, again, which will get you to a variety of resources related on today's topic. I strongly encourage you to visit the related links or resources page to browse through websites. We have those right now on the middle right of the screen under related URLs. So for those of you who are lucky enough to be watching the recorded version of today's webinar, you can still scroll through those links, click one of the links to select it, and then press the Browse To button to open it up. And I would ask each of you to fill out our brief online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's live delivery. Now, one of the most common questions that I receive as an organizer is if we offer CEUs or PDHs for our seminars. While we don't issue those types of credit hours, we can provide you with a participation certificate if you fill out the seminar feedback form. That goes for those of you watching the recorded version. So if you would like a certificate, whether you attended live or you are watching the archive, please follow the link to the online feedback form. Complete the feedback form, making sure that you check the box at the bottom of the form to certify you were here for the whole thing or replayed the entire delivery. And as soon as you submit the feedback form, you'll then immediately have access to a participation certificate with event details that you can either print out or save for your own record. Usually, if you take that certificate along with a copy of the presentation content or information on the seminar homepage, that's enough to document your participation and earn credit with your own institution. If there were others who joined from your location to watch today's session, simply share the link to the feedback form with those others. They can fill it out on their own. They don't need to have registered. Anyone can share feedback, and then they can get their own certificate for attending, even though they didn't register individually. So with that, again, I'll remind everybody that as soon as the archive is available for today's session, you'll automatically get an email with instructions on how to access it. So again, I want to thank everybody for joining us today. I want to thank all of our organizers and presenters who shared their expertise, and I hope that you'll join us on a future Internet seminar. This will be a formal conclusion for today.